for the whole network industry when somebody has a hit like that. Sherry thanked him, and Wright went on with a few pleasantries about the show and the attention it was getting. But of course, none of that was the real point of the call. Suddenly, Wright changed the tenor of the conversation. "Can I ask you a question?" Wright said. "This is a yes or no question. Did you bring this to NBC?" Sherry got the drift quickly. "Yes, I brought it to NBC first," he said. Wright, his unhappiness confirmed, asked Sherry what had happened. Sherry filled him in to the best of his recollection about how the script he had written had been delivered to NBC's comedy development department. Wright wanted to know if Sherry had names of the people who might have seen the script. Sherry, figuring a heaping helping of blame was about to be dished out, offered a few names. Then he said, "Well, they told me it was great and everything, and then they told me that they weren't so sure it was a comedy. So they were sending it over to drama. The next thing I got back was word that they were going to take a pass on it." When he hung up with Sherry, Wright concluded that he would have many more calls to make, calls to NBC development executives and the top managers at NBC Entertainment. He was determined to learn exactly what had happened, how NBC had missed this opportunity. As much as he was convinced that the future of television would be ruled by unpredictable, sweeping change, Wright knew one thing had not changed and would not change. No matter how they viewed television, on their computer monitors, on their cell phones, or on TV screens as big as medieval tapestries, people would still want to see hit shows. If you had hits, it would not matter where and how the revenue came in, you would always be in business. Until the fall of 2004, ABC had spent most of a decade consistently disproving one of the hoariest axioms of network television, that primetime programming was a cyclical business, where the losers would surely become winners eventually. Maybe no more, the analysts and critics and competitors said. Maybe ABC was the proof that television had changed irrevocably, that a network really on the skids could no longer launch a smash hit show that could turn around its fortunes, that a network could simply fail again and again until it ceased to matter as a competitive entity. In the space of 11 days between September 22nd and October 3rd, 2004, ABC shut the analysts and critics up. Even that early in the season, much of the nation was talking about not one but two new shows on ABC. Desperate Housewives was, with more than 21 million viewers, the most watched new show on ABC since 1996. Another new show, Lost, had also taken off immediately, drawing more than 18 million viewers and becoming a phenomenon from its first week on the air. Besides their explosive starts, both shows shared unusually turbulent backstories in how they reached the air, the kind that seemed to attach to every big hit the networks managed to find. The timing of the twin hits had profound consequences for ABC and its network competitors. With Desperate Housewives and Lost, a network had two instant breakout hits in the same season for the first time since NBC introduced ER and Friends in 1994. Those two shows had ushered in a decade of dominance for NBC. Now, 10 years later, that network saw the returns from its one-time bonanza finally falling to dust, and its own failure to replenish its roster of hits over that decade left NBC vulnerable to playing a painful game of role reversal with ABC. Suddenly, ABC had the hits, NBC didn't. And, as Bob Wright knew, it was no time for a network to be so bereft. The smash hit show was, more than ever, the lifeline for network television, the mother lode from which the big four networks, ABC, CBS, NBC, and Fox, along with the two part-time networks, WB and UPN, extracted more than $20 billion in advertising each year. Those billions were still the oxygen of the network business, and designer-suited men, as ever it was mostly men, in well-appointed offices in Manhattan and Burbank, California, now squirmed mightily with the effort to keep that air supply flowing. Already diminished by inroads from cable, the networks faced ever more serious threats from all kinds of digital and broadband competitors, endless temptations for viewers, especially the young ones they lusted after, to drift to other forms of entertainment and diversion. Having the smoking hot hit, the appointment show, the must-see TV that cable channels could not yet afford to produce, that a computer screen or BlackBerry or iPod could not hope to duplicate, was more than ever a life-or-death proposition for the business. In 2005, the networks themselves, noticing the tide of ad dollars drifting away to internet sites and other locations, set out with the fervor of the newly converted to find ways to build new revenue streams by feeding their programming into all those new micro and magna-sized outlets. Disney lined up a deal to play episodes of Desperate Housewives and Lost on Apple's latest invention, the Video iPod, a palm-sized picture of strikingly good quality, charging $1.99 for each episode ordered. NBC countered with a similar Apple iPod deal for a range of programs, including its still-potent late-night franchises, The Tonight Show and Late Night. CBS partnered with the Comcast cable empire to offer many of its shows on the increasingly popular technology of video on demand, which allowed viewers to catch up on episodes of their favorite shows for just 99 cents each. Behind every one of the deals was a critical assumption that each network would have hit shows that viewers would be willing to pay to see. Finding those hits was no easier than it had ever been, of course. It took a combination of boldness, vision, and extreme patience to be able to identify one standout show among the hundreds of ideas floated every year. And that's why network executives almost never found any. Instead, they mostly hoped that a breakthrough show would fall into their laps, the way most of the smash hits on television did. The plain truth was that no matter how much they spent on script development, which stars they signed to multi-million dollar deals, how many notes they gave on story beats and character arcs, hits most often arrived on a network executive's doorstep by chance, by whim, by blind, stupid luck. Network executives, highly paid and widely catered to, simply had to be ready to embrace it, fondle it, shower it with loving attention when a hit stumbled down the street and rang the doorbell. Most often they weren't. The 2004-2005 season was a watershed for network television, marked by sudden upheavals that rocked the business. In network entertainment divisions, with the big hit show more than ever the coin of the ratings realm, the effects of finding and owning the most and best of them became increasingly magnified. To understand the fate of each network in the 2004-2005 season, you had to track back where and how the hits had come from 3 or even 5 years previously. The net impact of hits accumulated or squandered over that period generated a seismic shift in the 2004-2005 season, one that had been boiling under the surface of the four-network competition since the late 1990s. Fox, the upstart fourth and still not full-time network, rode a wave of reality and sports programming and actually surpassed its far more established rivals for the entire season in the competition for viewers between the ages of 18 and 49, the standard that every network but CBS used as the only benchmark of success. At the same time, after years of disavowing the overarching significance of that 18 to 49 audience, CBS found itself in position to win by that younger standard and every other. No longer could the network be dismissed as appealing only to old people. In 2004, it was storming NBC's last stronghold, its Thursday night lineup. Behind a pair of totally unexpected and now long-running hits, CBS had conquered Thursday night, which by dint of the amount of ad dollars committed was unquestionably the most important night of television. NBC, a network that literally compared itself to the New York Yankees for the consistent excellence of its record, stood by helplessly as its own store of once great hits slowly melted away, leading to a precipitous and hugely costly plunge. And ABC, a network written off for dead in the press and most Hollywood conversations, effected the most startling change of all, awash in so much failure that it terminated the executive team that put its new roster of programs into production. ABC found its redemption in shows those executives had left behind. Which was only fitting, because, like something out of Dickens, success in network television usually depended on the stirring rise of the orphaned, the rejected, and the abandoned. Chapter 1. Beautiful Girls. Four network ships passing in the night. On a sunny Tuesday afternoon in Manhattan in mid-May of 2005, few people in the great city had reason to be as buoyant, as self-satisfied, as downright gleeful as the reserved, handsome, impeccably dressed 54-year-old man sitting in a prominent aisle seat in the orchestra section of Avery Fisher Hall in Lincoln Center. For Robert A. Iger, this was a day of real triumph, not merely because ABC, the network he had been associated with for virtually his entire career, all the way back to 1977, had emerged from a seemingly endless dark night of failure and financial loss to sudden, spectacular success, but also because he had survived one of the most precarious apprenticeships in media history. He had finally been designated as the successor to Michael Eisner, chairman of the Walt Disney Company. That appointment had come just 2 months earlier, and it was due in no small measure to the startling turnaround at ABC during the just-completed 2004-2005 television season. Iger, once the top programmer at ABC himself, had presided in his capacity as the number two Disney executive over nearly 10 years of flops. The network seemed to be allergic